Hey, what's happening? Welcome to the Hopitarian Show. I am Shane, and I am here today with Andrew Beck. He is the partner, creative director, co-founder over at Beck and Stone. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Shane, really happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, no problem. So I guess just first off, give a little introduction other than what I had just said about you and what Beck and Stone is and what they do.
Yeah, we are a what we call a brand consultancy, which means we like to tell people how to look, how to sound, to create these social constructs, right? The true social construct, this thing called a brand, which is the idea in your mind when you hear certain words or hear certain songs or see certain imagery. That's a brand, and so that's what we work to create. And we've had a bit of a reputation for developing brands and designing them and developing them and fundraising for them for mostly conservative / libertarian / classical liberal think tanks, nonprofit organizations, academic centers, institutions. So through this work, we're you know, proud of what we do. We sort of took something that was very needed on the right, and what I mean by the right is just anyone who's pretty much not insane, who isn't wrong, right? That is just the right. If you're not wrong, you're at least in the right, even if you're not on the right. We just gave them the same type of services that you get out in the real world. If you were going to contract McCann or Gray or WPP, you would get a great website. You would get creative professionals. You would get consultants who were going to steer you for your brand strategy, your go-to-market strategy, your art direction, your photography, your makeup and styling, your music, sound design. This is stuff that people on the right and conservatives and just don't even think about. But of course, we know how much those things impact, right? They shape what we think of when we think of when we hear certain words, when we listen to certain music, when we see certain people. And so this is the real war for the mind. And so I'm happy to be on the right side of that war, and I'm happy to have I think there's 12 of us now full time all across the United States who are in it with me.
Yeah, so I guess kind of growing on that and what you're talking about, how you're a brand consultancy, and so you're helping those who are on the right, whether they're, like you said, whether conservative, libertarian, classical liberal, however. I mean, there's even some left wingers out there who they would consider themselves left wing, but they're branded as a right winger because they have a wrong, quote unquote, wrong opinion on so and so topic. Yeah. So they're now a right winger. You know, I mean, yeah, freaking
we work with libs all the time, but it's just because they got pushed there.
Right. I mean, Anna Kasparian, I think, just recently tweeted, "I'm a woman," and then whatever she said after that, and people were like getting mad at her because she just had the audacity to say whatever she said. It's just, it's ridiculous out there. So I guess
that's now right wing. I mean, saying right. that you're a woman, that's right wing. Saying, I mean, really, just you just go down the list of all things. First, it was, well, you know, if you say that marriage is between man and woman, that's, you know, right wing. Now, if you say America's not an idea of America's a place, right wing. And we're just like, we have just really descended into this transnational, transhuman muck that like I am looking forward to more sane liberals accepting that it's just, you know, I'm not right wing. I just want to be right. And because you all are wrong.
So what do you think, especially like in the last 20 or 30 years or so, you can, like, what would you say is something that the right wing has gotten wrong in how they've tried to approach culture and how to brand themselves and how to kind of, because I'm sure you see it with who you work with or just out even on social media or even maybe out in person, where you're watching an advertisement on the television and it's like, oh, it's everyone's diverse now, you know, they're, oh, there's this multiracial couple, whatever. I mean, I have no problem with that. I mean, look at me, I'm half, so I'm totally okay with that, right?
But I'm just you're saying, also married to a half,
right?
So like,
right.
I mean, so.
But I guess
take that for what it is.
What I'm trying to say is, it's a lot different than what it was before, where America, I mean, it still is, but at the time, it was majority white. And that's what they were presenting themselves as. Oh yeah, it's a white couple. They have a couple of kids and all that stuff. And that's what they're presenting to America because that's what the majority of the world is, or majority of America. But now it's the opposite. Now they try their damnedest not to show any white person, especially a white straight male. Like if you're a straight white male, it's over. Game over for you, unless you play by the rules or if you're especially in a commercial or even in a movie, you're an idiot. You're stupid. You're the stupid person in the movie or whatever. So anyway, what I'm trying to say and what my question to you is, like, what is something that they've got, the right wing has gotten wrong in trying to present their values, and what is something that Beckenstone is trying to do to try to like reverse that?
Well, I would say they sort of gave up on culture in order to wage culture wars. And it just means reactionary talk about what the left, about what the mainstream media and Hollywood and the music industry and the government and all this stuff. They just talk about what they're doing wrong. And then essentially just seeding the ground of creation to their enemies. So like you can of course fight culture wars, but you fight culture with culture. And we've been in a one-sided war. And you know, when you can see, okay, there's somebody, I don't have any problem with anyone who doesn't have a problem with me. But then all of a sudden, when someone, it seems like you've got a problem with me. Like, what did I do to you? What's going on here? Suddenly that makes you feel a certain way. And so we took that feeling and then turned it into this like reactionary talk and geared our entire ecosystem of funding and enterprise. And our thought leadership is all geared towards talk, at least in the cultural space. We'll of course create Hobby Lobbies and Chick-fil-A's and you know, good old boy businesses and car dealerships, and that's like a conservative business, and that's fine and dandy. But when you realize that culture is starting to eat commerce for breakfast, You then say suddenly, well, we need to do something about culture. And then what do we do? Well, rather than invest in our own vision for it or find visionaries, we'll find reactionaries and we'll just pay them to talk and to sling mud. And I mean, you know, sometimes it's some pretty high quality mud, which makes great points. And we need those people to a degree, but you are really going to defeat a culture. I mean, this is really what is called wokeism. It was called political correctness before. People call it cultural Marxism. I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, it's just the thing. I mean, it's just it. It's defeated by another it. You have to create something that is a, you know, not just a reaction to it, but an antidote for it. And it isn't just about creating options. It isn't about creating a parallel universe where we have our own economy and we have our own movies. That's kind of what Christians did, like the, you know, evangelical Christians. And it turned out to be mostly cringe. I mean, Focus on the Family, I think, if you know them, they were way out in front. It's James Dobson's place. And they had it going from, I mean, like Bible materials, but then going into like books. And they had this really popular show called Adventures in Odyssey that was all based upon audio. It was on tape. I remember listening to it when I was a kid, but it was also on radio. They made movies out of it. I mean, this was impactful culture. Christian contemporary music was actually really good at one point. In the 90s, I mean, 80s and 90s, CCM was better in many regards to secular music. And to the point where secular labels were like, we got to hire some of these Christian people. I mean, Amy Grant and Switchfoot and Skillet and people who were like actually good started to be like crossover hits. Jars of Clay. Christian now, though, has become this byword for subpar. And subpar, not just in terms of like the message, but in terms of just the quality of the storytelling, of the production values, of the acting, and it's geared towards a niche versus being geared towards the culture at large. And so you don't want to create pockets. You don't want to create little pockets of resistance, because that's what they want. They want you to become a ghetto so that you stay in that ghetto and you don't come out and then seed public funding for the arts and culture. You cede it to them. You cede the airwaves to them through things like public radio and through not investing in broadcasting. You cede things like social media and technology to them by letting them create and control these massive tech platforms and then not creating anything similar of your own. So the lack of ambition in culture actually isn't just like, oh, you won't, you know, you don't do artsy fartsy things like the libs or the progs do. No. It's like you have to see culture as something that is an organism, and it has all these various parts to it, which includes things like technology, and which include things like politics. But yeah, at the end of the day, you do need to have a visionary, a luminary, or a group of these people that actually creates compelling quality, but explicitly contrarian, or just something that is going to be that competing vision for your values and against the values of the other, rather than just talk about how cringe and how bad and how evil theirs is, and then make your own little ghettos for yourself where you will eventually be starved or strangled out.
So what would your reaction then be to like a company like the Daily Wire, who did that whole hurt the chocolate bar thing where they, oh, we have a she, her, and a he, him. Guess which one has the nuts? Good one, right? But that was the whole reaction. As you were just saying, they're just now like a reactionaries, but it was just a reaction to Hershey's doing this ad campaign where I think they had like a trans person as their person, that was like their spokesperson or something like that, that was doing, I'm not 100% sure on that, but it was basically just a reaction to that. And also the Daily Wire creating kind of their own like film and media production company where they're making movies. And mm-hmm. I think they're supposed to come up with some children's programming soon or whatever. So like, do you think that's a step in the right direction, or do you think that's just kind of another instance of they're just reacting to what the other people are doing?
Well, all right. So I don't want to say too much here because I don't want to get in trouble with some of my friends at the Daily Wire. But I think it is safe to say that there's different types of things. So the whole Jeremy's razors and Jeremy's chocolate or whatever we have now, which I didn't even see the whole Hershey's thing, because I don't eat Hershey's, and you know, I'm more plugged into what the Daily Wire is doing than what Hershey's is doing, which might be sad, but like, it also shows the power of the reach and also just the circles that I'm in. And, you know, stuff like that's a meme. It's a meme brand. It's done mainly for marketing purposes. And, they have a great team over there that can make stuff quickly. They can kind of ideate stuff and then execute it, relatively quickly and with like high quality production values and, you know, doing sort of the same things that the libs do, but in a more lean and mean fashion. And, it's all just part of marketing. That's part of their brand. They've become, and some people like this, some people don't like this. I personally don't. I don't like how they have become the persona for what a conservative is in America. But maybe that's best. I mean, maybe that truly is what a conservative in America is. And that just the ones that I've been exposed to are very smart and tactful and in a sense gentle, and you know, nuanced and academic, and that's just because that's my experience to conservatism. Whereas this particular brand, sort of like Trump's brand, it's like kind of memeing it, you know, it's like making it something that is not really a way of life, but a way of presenting yourself on the internet. And I just, it's probably a very effective marketing strategy because they know their audience and they have that ghetto of like conservative people. And that's who they get. And it's a very large ghetto. But for instance, with the move with Jeremy's Razors, Harry's was one of their advertisers. And, you know, Harry's Razors leaves you, and that's millions of dollars that you are now losing. That's coming just through running ads. And so the wake-up call, and I know this from having spoken with someone at the Daily Wire, even before this all happened, and they said that they were going to start working on these special projects that were going to be more entrepreneurial because they saw the danger in their model, that if they only relied upon advertising, it doesn't matter how many eyeballs you have. You have to have someone who's willing to pay you to reach those eyeballs. And that's exactly what happened. This whole concept of brand safety came into the libs lexicon, came into the advertising industry, and they discouraged media buyers and brand managers from spending money on explicitly conservative stuff, platforms and publishers. And so you are cutting off the funding, and then therefore you then can't stay in business. And so something like Harry's, okay, if like Harry's is giving them millions upon millions of dollars every year, Jeremy's Razors is not going to make that back up. It takes a lot more to run your own company than it takes to show some ads on your existing business model. So there are some real fundamental challenges there. And what it shows you is that, yes, it is effective marketing, but it is also them trying to invest in other means that shores up their business model. It's the same thing then with the films, realizing that, okay, we have the ability to make films and we have some investors here who are very willing to give us money to experiment with stuff. And we have some talent lined up, whether it's actors or whether it's directors and producers, who are willing to make this for us at this cost. This stuff isn't getting into theaters. This stuff's going to be on YouTube. People got to pay for it. We got to drive people towards paying for original content, doing the Netflix model. And that's of course what Jeremy was laying out in that talk, where he sort of laid out the plans for the company, the plans to make it more of this entertainment media company, starting new shows like the sports talk one, Crane or something now. And then, okay, yeah, it's just going to be about sports, you know? These alternatives to the other thing, it really does remind me of some of what Focus on the Family and some of the religious right was doing in the late 80s and really throughout the 90s, right? You're kind of giving like a Christian alternative to the worldview. You know, here's the Christian alternative to video games. I mean, remember those? Like, you know, you had to, you know, I was like, you know, Bible guy or whatever. And so It's like, if your kids are gonna play video games, make sure that they're playing Bible games. And you know, I'm not gonna hate on that necessarily, but that's sort of what the Daily Wire is like doing. Like, hey, do you like this? Do you like the New York Times podcast in the morning, which goes through the news for you? Well, we'll give you the same thing, but it's going to be conservative and it's going to say conservative-y things, right? That is again, like it could be very successful for them, but it's showing how, I mean, one, they are creating this this meme of like what it means to be a conservative. And I mean, frankly, everything that they put out there, everything that they say, everything that they do, even among conservatives, among, people who, yeah, may not like the main thing. I mean, you know, we don't like the New York Times, but we want to see quality reporting. We want to see thoughtful articulation of ideas. We want to see high quality art. We want an accurate reporting of the news. We want solid expert analysis on the things that are going on in the world. And if you don't provide those things, if it comes across like these are partisan intellectually stunted takes on all this stuff, it loses its shine. It loses its effectiveness. You know, it isn't so much that people want a conservative version of the New York Times. They just want the New York Times to stop being so bad and stop being so unfair and stop being just the way that it is. It's the same thing with Hollywood. It's the same thing with the entertainment industry. It's the same thing with tech. It's the same thing with the government. You know, like we don't mind that you exist. We don't want like fake versions of you. We just don't want you to hate us. We just don't want you to be like actively against what I am standing for. Like, can't you relax? And so that's why I think that the attempts to market themselves and they kind of have to embrace that reactionary, contrarian, meme like marketing of like, I'm a conservative version of Hershey's. It has to get more and more absurd. The rhetoric has to keep getting like more and more ramped up in order for the audience to stay engaged, or else it just begins to fall flat. How many different times can they take Jeremy so and so and have him show up with like a woman, you know? there's like some of that stuff where you are just going to have to say, yeah, that meme is dead. We're going to have to find another one. So I have hopes for them. I have hopes that they are going to sort of see, okay, we need to sort of normalize here. We can't always be on like the, you know, cutting edge forefront of this stuff. Because even with the big thing that they're talking about now, the trans people. Great. But like, is there something else? Is there like something else that we can talk about? Is there like other things going on in the world? I mean, what's What about what's going on with like war? I mean, maybe we should talk about war. Maybe we should talk about banks. You know, maybe we should talk about food. Maybe we should talk about poverty. Maybe we should. Hey, there's a ton of stuff, and it just feels like the culture war issues suck all the air out of the room, and it then causes the brand to be known for you're just here to push people's buttons on one side and get the other side riled up about the same stuff. That's not a true alternative. That's more what I was describing in the beginning. It's this cultural reactionaryism that's just not creating culture. It's just straining the existing one.
So if I guess I know you say you didn't want to like kind of because you know you have friends over at the Daily Wire, and they're just like the big conservative right-wing brand, and so if they're gonna try and like go away from the like being a meme of itself and what a conservative means, then how would you shape what conservative then means to people that maybe are interested in conservative values, or they're politically homeless, they don't know where they fit in. So how would you brand conservatism?
Conservatism, look, it's really difficult because it's sort of like libertarianism, right? When you say libertarianism, certain people come to your mind. You know, people walking around, I don't know, like smoking pot on a stage, like naked, saying, "Oh, it's like this is kind of what libertarians."
And that's libertarians' fault doing that. I mean, there's that, you know, that meme where it's, "Oh yeah, here's a libertarian and what they believe in, it's great." But then who they bring up to share those values are freaking who knows what, you know?
Correct. And this is unfortunately what happens with all these sort of intellectual traditions, because when you talk about things like conservative values, there's no such thing. It's that conservatism is an intellectual tradition that stretches back to the middle of the 20th century. This is when this thing kind of started to become a thing. And you know, there's Straussianism, and there's West Coast Straussianism, and there's East Coast Straussianism, and there's conservatives, and there's neoconservatives, and there's paleoconservatives, and we're talking about different factions of intellectuals. And I can appreciate intellectual traditions. I think that they are important, and that people should get a very wide and broad understanding of what smart people have said about the books and the conversations and the ideas and the films and the music and the art and the culture and the architecture and the policy and the wars and the enterprises and the explorers that have shaped their world, that have come before them and that are currently shaping them now. And conservatism is part of that. Once people started to make this thing, like once they really caught on into, well, I am a conservative, and it was no longer this whole thing of like, talking about, you know, intellectuals. I mean, really, like conservatives were just liberals who said, like, I can't be on board with what my fellow liberals are about anymore. And so they then kind of switched sides. There was a splintering that happened among the elites, really. And that's where you get things like, you're a liberal, you're a conservative, you're a progressive, or you're a neoliberal, you're a neoconservative, or any one of these various stripes, right? So what I would do is I would just stop calling yourself conservative. I mean, that's like the long and short of it. You stop using political language, you stop using the language of the elites to describe something that should be the touchstone of the masses. And you notice how the New York Times does not say the liberal New York Times. No, you have to call them that because they won't call themselves that. See, this is how winners behave. This is how people who are secure in their identities behave. They give the pretense, they give the appearance of being neutral. They don't become the meme. They always take the high ground. Now, if that's what if that's what I would do, you know, and like, look, the Daily Wire makes millions of dollars. It's probably too late for them to make any kind of position. What I would say is that if there is going to be a second shot at something like the Daily Wire taking hold of culture, getting into the mainstream as much as it has, that's really what we are talking. You need to create something that is going to appeal to the broad majority. And if you call it, or if you make it too much, it like it is a something that is only for a certain type of people who have a more political persuasion, a political stance, rather than it's about ideas and you know how you vote and you know where you stand on like certain things and whatever, versus something that's more moving in Geist, in something that's spiritual. People can just feel that okay, this is legitimate. This is an actual competitor and an alternative to something like the massive institutions that spend hundreds of millions of dollars keeping themselves that way. Very inflated sense of worth in like the public's mind. I mean, that's what places like the New York Times do. That's what places like the United Nations. I mean, just go down the list. This stuff is all based upon money that is being spent to keep them in people's minds a certain way. So you need to invest in the wars of Geist in order to influence the zeitgeist. And really, that's what conservatives are failing at. We're failing to move the zeitgeist because we don't really work in spiritual things. We work in purely mental or verbal means.
Well, they're also, like we've been saying before, that they're just kind of reacting to what the left or liberals or whatever you want to call them, what they're doing, because at the end of the day, at least as of right now, they're winning. And it's like you were saying, the New York Times don't have to call themselves a certain type of political spectrum, because we're the New York Times and we're the biggest newspaper in the world. And why do you, you know, you could be a conservative author, but they still put the number one New York Times bestseller. You know, they don't put like, oh, I'm the number one bestseller at such and such, because at the end, no one really cares. Nobody cares. Wait, you're number one where? I never heard of it. I don't know what you're talking about. So
conservatives still care about what goes on at Harvard and Stanford and Yale and all these places, because they like those places. They still value what those places represent, which is honor, which is respect, which is success, which is power. And that's why, you know, creating an alternative that is going to combat that type of place, that the like pole position that these places, these institutions have in people's minds, that is extraordinarily difficult. It's very much easier to peel off a very small subset of that audience and just hype those people up to just the max and just maximize the lifetime customer value of the smaller group of people, because then you have a pretty legitimate business. And I mean, that's I'm afraid sort of where we stand right now with conservatives and brand building.
So to kind of get into a couple of examples about that. So one of your tweets that you had tweeted a couple months ago that got viral, got a lot of eyes on there. It was about architecture, which is something you had also mentioned as well earlier. So your tweet is a new statue atop a New York City courthouse. The artist says it's part of an, quote, urgent and necessary cultural reckoning underway as New York reconsiders traditional representations of power in public spaces and recasts civic structures to better reflect 21st century social mores. Now, that's just one of like a thread that you kind of did to talk about this, but can you kind of just talk about what we're seeing here? Because to me, and this is just me kind of, I don't know if this is 100% accurate or not, but to me, it just looks like it looks like a nude woman, probably supposed to represent a black woman, where she has like kind of like the hairs going down. It looks like it's, I don't know, like a spiral looking thing or whatever. And it's like, it looks like a gold pick a thing where a lot of the other statues in New York City and just and around the country are kind of more that marble, kind of that's like white type of looking thing. And so this one is like, well, no, we're a gold because we got to be different. So would you say what I described like an accurate representation of that, or did the artist say anything else about that?
So all that I did was just take something from the New York Times art section and put it on Twitter, because like no conservative is going through the New York Times art section. And so then like a couple of people, Michael Knowles, people from the Daily Wire, Mike Cernovich, various people kind of picked it up and then ran with it. But like
there's whole things, well, it's demonic, they're like, you know, casting some kind of spiritual hex over the city or whatnot. And I mean, yeah, sure. Great. Yeah, no, awesome. But my personal issue with it is that it's just bad. And like what you're describing. So for instance, you say nude woman, I don't see any nudity there. And not that I necessarily want to see nudity, but if there was like, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it's actually meant to kind of represent Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which is why you have this the judge's apron there, and why it's a woman and whatever. And it's just like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, like she would be mortified if she saw that and that was her representation. Wait, I mean, she probably
that's supposed to be a representation of
read the next tweet. The statue, okay. Named now it's just called Now, and I mean it like literally is NOW all caps Now, is a female figure emerging from a pink lotus. It has braids shaped as horns with a judicial lace apron. It is meant to pay homage to Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her fight for abortion. Now that is from the New York Times article. That is from the artist saying this is what the statue is about. Now, if I was someone who said I want to represent and really glorify Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her like kind of pet issue, or at least the issue that she became most known for, which is killing babies. Okay, that is what I'm about.
How dare you?
I would not present it, and you could kind of see the details of it if you click into one of those photos. Like, that's a very bad way of doing that. No, like up, yeah, or you know, like this one here. You can kind of click on this, like in like this New York Times. But let's just look at this. There is no artistic quality to this. Even the craftsmanship in how it's put together looks like it's something that's 3D printed. It looks like it's made of plastic, not of marble. There's the aesthetic qualities of it is signaling something that if like I was saying, if I was the one who they came to us and they said, we want you to make the statue and glorify this like old lady who is now dead, but people it's known, you know, it's known in the imagination of people as being this old lady who defends killing babies, I would make it look like the dudes who are standing next to her. And if you go back up, you can kind of see, right, there's this lineup. Oh wow, these like stately white marble things. And then you have this. It's just bad. It's just literally bad. Now, would conservatives have had the same reaction to it if it was done in the neoclassical style? If it was Ruth Bader Ginsburg made to look like she was Cicero or something, you know? Would there have been the same reaction?
Just from this photo alone, it's like your eyes go right to it because it looks different from everything else. Everything else is just marble, kind of gray color. But then you go, it's right there.
Amateur. Yeah. It is from an artist who is very much caught up in her own story. It's somebody who, to even call it now, all caps now. It's just this is an abomination, not before God, but just before Andrew Beck. It's just before New York City. This is New York City paid for this thing. They paid this artist, and they're going to go on a tour, and they're going to do this other places. You should be ashamed of yourself. You're supposed to represent the arts and culture. Like the world comes to you for this stuff, and this is what you're saying is worth spending the public's money on. This is what belongs on top of your courthouse. It's just ugly, and that's the end of the story, really. It's sure, is there all sorts of is there hidden meaning in it and everything? I wouldn't give this artist that much credit. I don't even think that she was thinking that deep into it. She was making something that had to be different. And this is what she came up with.
So New York City, they hired her to make that.
Yes, this is publicly funded art. Yeah.
For what reason? To be like, well, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is dead. Can you make something to commemorate her honor or something like that? Like, but that doesn't look anything like her. Like, if I looked at that statue, how am I supposed to go? Yeah, that's supposed to represent Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Wow, yeah, so RBG. Cool. Yep, there she is.
If you're gonna represent or if you're gonna honor our, wouldn't you like maybe I don't know, make a statue that looks like her? I mean, every single statue that when they make a monument of someone, they try to make it look like the person. I don't know. Maybe I'm stupid. I don't know.
Think about like the whole Martin Luther King statue, and you're just like, where is that? Is that in Boston or in Philadelphia? Again, this is publicly funded. This is publicly funded stuff, and it then comes out, and you're like, I thought we were going to honor the man. You know, like where's the honor in this? And that's what I don't like about it. I don't like how we are forced to look at something and say, what a beautiful robe you're wearing, Emperor. No, someone has to say the Emperor has no clothes. This is ugly. And frankly, the more libs are embarrassed by this stuff. And this is part of why I don't regret what I did in starting this, little mild firestorm. And you're getting in on all these different sites and saying, oh, look at what they're doing in New York City and it's demonic and whatever. I don't mind doing that because there's a certain sense of shame that we should have when we do a bad job. When you do a good job, you should be congratulated. You should be rewarded. You should feel a sense of honor and glory that comes from doing a good job. But like lifting up something that is poor quality, that where you did a bad job, you should not be rewarded for this. You should be embarrassed about this. And if the city, if the client, so to speak, which is the city of New York, is not going to say this is trash, we're not putting this up, then you know what? Maybe the public has to.
Well, if the taxpayers were paying it, I mean, I'm sure
taxpayers don't have any say in this.
Yeah.
They got zero say. But this is why even in things like when they talk about public architecture, and the public is given any choice between a brutalist building, one that's called brutalist. Brutalism is fine. It's just no one knows how to do it in the United States. They just can't. They're just not very good at it.
like or the sort of like the you know neoclassical style, or really any other style that's just not like just whatever this like ugly Fed style is, the public always chooses the more traditional looking option, the more classical looking option. They always do, and that's why they stopped taking polls. They just stopped asking the public, because if it came down to a vote, nobody would vote for this stuff. And then their friends wouldn't get money, and their supporters wouldn't get, you know, kickbacks, and they wouldn't be able to keep waging whatever they this is a pretty poor example of waging culture war. I usually give, you know, them a lot of credit for doing a good job in like how dastardly and how subtle and how good their propaganda is, and you know how like well done their psyops are executed. But this one's just bad. This is just
Well, I mean, yeah, the fact that they stopped doing polls because more people would vote for something else that they didn't want, that's like, oh, good, democracy needs to be protected, but only if it's the democracy that I like.
Right.
Know? Right. And then
But nobody votes for war anymore. See, like, we fund wars and we go to war. When was the last time that you voted to go to war? When was the last time that Congress voted to go to war? I mean, I guess it was Iraq. But like, we've been at war. Syria, Libya, Ukraine, Serbia. You name
no,
it.
No, the Ukraine war only started a year ago. So you don't even know. You don't know what you're talking about, Andrew.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, yeah. You're right. I mean, but it's like not even Congress votes for this stuff, let alone ask the actual American, hey, do you want to start to drop bombs on these people? I don't really want to drop bombs on anybody at the moment, but I mean, maybe it would be nice if you asked me before you did. Like, I thought I was part of this country, you know? And so like, that's just indicative of just what they mean by democracy. They mean their vision of the world, and their vision of the world is the one that you must accept in order to be part of the democracy. And if you don't want to accept that, well, then the democracy is not for you. You don't get to participate in it. And then, is that truly democracy? Where is the demos in that?
So,
it's not democracy. It's oligarchy. It's bureaucracy.
Yeah. So like, okay. So the city of New York asked this person to make this statue or whatever. And of course, the city of New York is a vast majority blue. So they're like, oh, that is awesome. Let's just do that. And really, one of the only ways that I can think of that you can have something where that doesn't happen, or if they are going to make a statue, it's just going to look like that kind of that classic look of what most statues look like nowadays. You would have to have the right wing win elections there. But at the same time, it's kind of like, you know, because there's people out there who say, well, just get out of the cities, because at this point the cities are kind of not dead, but it's like game over, basically. It's like, I don't know, maybe so instead don't worry about the cities, because they're already it's already a lost cause, right? Which I totally understand that viewpoint, because especially in New York, if he's like Republicans running for governor, I mean, how much percent are they gonna get? 30 maybe? I mean, the last governor they had was what, Giuliani.
Yeah, but I mean, look, like we underestimate how narrow some of the margins are, and that New Yorkers voted for Mike Bloomberg 3 times because they kind of like competence, and there's only a certain degree that they're gonna be pushed when something starts to really break down. Because what usually follows with this kind of leftist ideology, incompetence follows close behind it. It always has, whether it was in Russia, whether it's in Venezuela, whether it's in Cuba, whether it's, I mean, and you know, whether it's in blue cities like this, it just goes behind and then wreck stuff and makes things rot. They take over these places that was built that were built by competent people, and it's usually people that are of a more traditional viewpoint. They're people who were motivated by rewards. They're motivated by religion. They were motivated by family and by honor. Whereas these people, when they're motivated just by envy and by bitterness over you know what they were kept from, once they get control of the things that they were kept from, they fritter them away. They aren't prepared to do the work necessary to maintain those systems. And that's what we're seeing really across the United States, is that people, the infrastructure, the competency, the systemic competency of these cities that for a long time were actually running pretty well from like the middle of the century. They were almost running too well, as in they bulldozed neighborhoods and destroyed, great buildings and architecture and broke up families and created all sorts of these radical social engineering projects so that they could put a highway through. So they could do these massive, public infrastructure projects. I mean, that was bad, but it was at least competent. They got it done, and that's scary. But now we're not even at that. Now that competency has been those people are long gone, these cities are now running on fumes. They're operating in the shells of the people who came before them. It's like manning the walls of a city that haven't been kept up. I mean, maybe it's Hadrian's Wall or whatever we want to do. It was built a long time ago and it was impressive then, but if it's not kept up by people who are willing to commit to its defense and to its upkeep, eventually the wall is going to fall down, the wall is going to go into disrepair, and then the invading army is going to come in and take it over. You're gonna lose whatever benefit that the infrastructure was providing you. And that's what I think we're at now with these cities, but that there's only going to be a certain limit that the liberals are going to tolerate it, because they ultimately enjoy culture. They enjoy nice things. They enjoy peace and quiet. This is why they don't have kids. They enjoy good food and quality service. They enjoy beautiful art, and they enjoy living in beautiful buildings. In New York and in many of the major cities, there's still a pretty thriving classical music scene, because they still actually enjoy good music and quality theater. They know that there's good stuff. They just want it for themselves. And they're only going to tolerate the deprivation or the corruption of those things for so long before there is, okay, well, now we're going to vote for Mike Bloomberg. And what Mike Bloomberg was a tyrant. He was a dictator. It's like in ancient Rome, the city of Rome, in times of crisis, the Senate elected a dictator, and that dictator took over, got them through the crisis, and then stepped down. New York City, if it's left to the bureaucracy to run it, they run it into the ground. If it's they create art like that, but then you turn it over to a rough and tumble businessman like Mike Bloomberg, he just gets stuff done. He just does stuff, and he just buys his way into your ballot, but then he works his way into your heart. And that's why everyone in New York can look back on the days of Bloomberg and be like, oh, that wasn't so bad. Because then de Blasio takes over and just runs whatever de Blasio had into the ground, because he expanded the bureaucracy, because he let the bureaucracy take over.
Yeah, then Bloomberg tried to run for president, and that worked out great for him.
Yeah. There was this place in me where I'm just like, I mean, there were some great candidates on the Democratic side. Just there was Tulsi Gabbard,
and there was Andrew Yang, and there was Marianne Williamson. I mean,
was Andrew Yang actually a good candidate, though?
I'm not saying good as in like good. I'm saying like interesting, fun, okay. And like Bernie used to be the funnest that they had. Bernie looked totally normie compared to these other people. And then there's Mike Bloomberg. He's like, I'm going to enter the race and I'm going to spend just, what did he spend? Like $1 billion. I mean, just, he spends his absolute fortune. Yeah. He spends his absolute fortune. People are like, I'm not voting for him, but I'm working for him because he's paying me a lot of money. It sounds good to me. Like he just like thought he could entrepreneur, like hack his way into it. And then the Democratic Party is just like, nope, we're going with Joe Biden no matter what you do. And then he then realized like, I can't do jack with the Democrats. I'm going to be an independent again.
Wow. Yeah. So I guess you had mentioned the army, and that was another thing that you were also talking about where like the military now for sure is more like at first it started with the whole, like, don't say gay. No, it was don't say gay. Something like that.
No. It was don't ask, don't tell.
Oh, that's right. Don't ask, don't tell. Yeah. It started with don't.
Right. It's just don't, and then something gay.
Yeah. So is that another institution that you feel that kind of needs to go back to how it was before? Because they seem to really, because like we were talking before we were recording, where they're talking about like recruitments and stuff like that, where like, I don't know what the numbers are, but I would probably guess they're not as high as they used to be. And so that's why you hear people about talking about the draft. I mean, I don't, that would be like the most drastic low level of them actually implementing that again. If they were going to do that, that's like, we're super desperate and we're just going to
Don't put it by them, because recruitment is, because, you know, you're not just guessing that recruitment is down. Recruitment is down, and it's down by a lot, and it has been for a long time. And now when it looks like, okay, we may need a military. We tried to bluff Russia into backing down. They didn't back down. They went after Ukraine and our interest in Ukraine and our different, you know, pools of special interests and special projects. They went after it. And like, you know, now when it's like, okay, we need to actually fight. And of course there's plenty of American mercenaries, private contractors, people who are willing to you know, do things off the books, off the record, off the grid, solid fighters. One of these guys is, I mean, 20 other men, I don't care where you're from. And they've been doing a lot of work in Ukraine for quite a while. But there is still only a, you know, limited number of those people. And many of them, of course, are former people who served in the military, in the army, or one of those various units with distinction. They got solid combat experience. They're killing machines. They're smart. They're intelligent. There's only so many of them. And what you realize too is that you can make a whole lot more money going private and getting paid by the Department of Defense than just sticking and being a soldier, right? So like, why, if you know that you're really good, why would you keep being a soldier when you can do what you're best at for the top dollar as a contractor? So, and look, it's like this, you know, same thing like the federal government. You don't encourage people to stick it out and do the best that they possibly can, because you're not really motivating them. You motivate them to go private and to be a consultant or join the board of some place, and then get them government contracts based upon the connections that you have made and the, you know, your ability to navigate the system and to talk to people to smooth things over. This is the whole thing about, I mean, and you know, people do this all over the place, but like Hunter Biden, you know, okay, why was Hunter Biden getting paid that much money to be sitting on the board of some place? It's pretty simple. It's a pretty straightforward answer. But the point is that you're not encouraging good people to stay and fight for their country, to, you know, serve their country, quote unquote,
in the military if there are these if there's these lack of incentives. And so people talk a lot about the recruitment problem, but they don't really talk about the like loss of talent problem on the other end. So like if you're constantly losing your best talent and you have to replace them with people, and you're not really replacing these people, these guys who are worth, and when I say guys, I mean men. I mean like they are all men. I can pretty much guarantee you it. They are losing these guys and are not able to replace them. So when it's like, hey, yeah, one of these guys is worth 10 enemy combatants. What if one of these guys is worth more than 20 American soldiers? Then it's like, these are just irreplaceable people. And if recruitment is down, you know, it isn't so much about just raw numbers. The military is massive. The military has a ton of people, but like the actual, what is a fighting force? The people who can go out there right now and start killing people and actually waging war. That's what I'm more interested in. And I haven't seen this data. I don't know if they kind of make this public because, you know, you say, well, there's millions in the military. There's just a ton of people. But it's like these people, like, are they actual like fighters? Will they go and kill people? I think it's panic mode in the military. They kind of know that the, you know, not just the raw numbers in terms of like, oh yeah, people who can, you know, be a mechanic on something. Oh, sure. It's like it's great to have those people. Oh, like a logistical personnel, or, you know, someone who went to someone who's a diversity, equity, and inclusion officer or someone. Okay, look, like, all right, fine. You can have those people. But what about the people who are going to kill people? I think that's what's scaring them. And that's why what we were talking about is the shifting in the recruitment strategy, in the advertising, trying to shift the brand perception, specifically of the Army, back to being about fighters. And frankly, targeting men again in their advertising. I think it's because they are starting to realize that that like reality is just on them now, and like now it, you know, with like the threat of a or you know, not so much the threat, but the desire perhaps for a hot war in the near future. They need fighters, and they just don't have them.
So real quick before we end this, what do you think kind of started that downtrend of recruitment? Like, you know, kind of a...
I think it's like difficult for me because there was a point where I wanted to serve in the military when I was younger, because I studied military history. I wanted to either be a historian or I wanted to be in the military. And when it sort of like dawned on me that like, we don't really fight the wars that I studied. Like we don't, and that even, I mean, one, like just like even just the wars that I had read about, studying American history and studying European history, it's just like the nobility was gone from war. It was hard for me to see myself as an American soldier. It was hard for me to picture killing somebody on behalf of the United States. And what I mean is on behalf of the United States government. And that's just sad. Because I can of course envision myself killing somebody for my country, as in if someone tries to invade my country, I will take to the battlefield, and I will be willing to kill and be killed to defend the United States. So that's as part of your sovereign oath as a citizen. You are in the militia, whether you like it or not. We're just very blessed to never be faced with that. And then second, I am then willing to die to protect my family and my loved ones. I am willing to kill for that. I'm not willing to go kill somebody in a far off land for an idea. I'm not willing to go and kill somebody for the sake of democracy. And that's something that's not just like a mental thing. It is something that is more spiritual. And that goes back to, what I was saying, about how brands fail is that they don't move in Geist. They move mentally, they move logically. And the military started recruiting when they realized that there was a downward trend that they, and I mean, this is perhaps in the 90s. There wasn't really any wars going on. I mean, the last war that we had fought, Vietnam, was incredibly unpopular. And I don't really call the first Iraq war an actual war, but it at least got people amped up. I mean, there was some feeling of like, we just kicked their butts. Like, we went in there and we blew them up. We owned them. There was this invincibility that was there, but it was still this, relatively like smaller elite force. In the minds of the general public, Vietnam was incredibly unpopular. It was very ugly. And it left a scar on the United States, whereas something like World War II, there was a sense of great victory, We defeated the evil, Nazi enslavers and also those Japanese people, which was, really what was kind of motivating the Pacific War. It was more of a race war than anything. Without having those motivations, recruitment started to tank. And so then you have to turn to a recruitment strategy that's about career advancement. It's not about killing people. I forget where it was. It might have been a newspaper article that I had dug up somewhere talking about how there was a ton of people who did not want to go into the first Iraq war because they said, you promised me that I would not have to fight. You promised me that I would not get shot at. Because I would be out in X number of years, and you would pay for my college tuition, and you would give me VA benefits, and you would help me get a mortgage, and you would do this, you do that. The military should not be about getting to board first on a plane. The military should be about, I'm gonna kill people, and like I could maybe get killed myself, and if that spirit de corps left at a certain point, the incentives to join the military became very lackluster. One, because I think America kind of lost that nobility in its warfare, and therefore lost the nobility in being a soldier. Then we made it about a career outside of the military, all the extra benefits, rather than making it about actually fighting. And 9/11 and wanting to kill Arabs kind of fixed that temporarily. You got a lot of fresh people who just wanted to go out there and just like, go to the Middle East and just fry Arabs, after 9/11. That provided like a kind of a shot in the arm. But even that shot wore off pretty quick. And it wasn't enough to truly fix the recruitment problem, at least like change the trajectory. At a certain point, you need to be fighting noble wars in order to get noble warriors. Or else, there is a no reason to for like anyone who can actually fight, because again we're talking about fighting men here. There is no reason for actual fighting men to join up. There's just no motivation. Or if they do join up, they make a beeline to getting out as quickly as possible.
So we'll end it there. I just want to add what you were just saying about that, especially with like 9/11 and how a lot of people, when they were seeing the towers go down and everything like that, and it's like, oh man, like a lot of people were thinking, wow, this is an attack on our country. Yeah. So they felt obligated to join and go over there. They weren't even thinking about like, what's the actual reason why they did this? Like, why would they fly planes in the towers? Like the history of all that, and how there's like this really murky gray area of America and what they were trying to tell the public, as opposed to what was really happening, or whatever you want to feel about all that.
But it's just like Pearl Harbor. It is just like Pearl Harbor. And like, rather than like us seeing things through the pain, I spent most of my life in New York City, man. Like, my dad is from South Brooklyn. We had people who were in our church who were directly affected, you know, who had coworkers in that World Trade Center, you know, whether it's cops or firefighters. I just, like, believe me, you want to go out there, you want to kill people. I mean, that is a natural reaction to it, but it's just, you also have to see it for, like a proportionate response. And our response to 9/11 was disproportionate, both domestically and internationally. And that's what justice is. You know, people want justice. But justice is about equal responses. Okay, you did this, and this is now worthy of this response. In order for the scales to be even, right? There's a justice scale. But we just dropped way too much on the other side, without really even knowing what was on this other side, like you're saying, and like, you know, there's this verse in the Bible that says, "He that hasteth," because I read King James, "He that hasteth with his feet sinneth." So if you haste, if you make haste, you are likely to sin, because you make bad decisions when it's in the heat of the moment. We get angry and we do things. I used to go to Rikers Island and talk to guys. My dad was a chaplain there, so many of the people there were normal dudes. And again, it was all dudes, but like normal dudes who in a moment of anger did something that they shouldn't. And we can be that way as a person, but we could be that way as a society as well. And that's what happened after December 7th, 1941. And that is what happened after September 11th, 2001. And, you know, we made haste with our feet, and it led to all sorts of different things that if, you know, we could take it back, if we could take back that, you know, firebombing and then nuking of Japan. I mean, there's like people who don't think that that's wrong. I absolutely think that it was wrong. It was not a proportionate response at all. And that makes it unjust. And so America needs to fight wars again that are just wars. There is such a thing as a just war. I'm not a pacifist, but there needs to be, we need to say, we need to fight wars, not out of anger, not out of revenge. We need to fight wars that are good and that are noble. That's what kind of motivated Americans to go to Europe, right? As well, because we're gonna free them from, you know, the yoke of oppression. And like, that impressed a whole lot of people. That built up a lot of goodwill for the United States, that like our guys were willing to go over and kill and be killed in large numbers to like free somebody else.
because there's something noble about that. There's something selfless about that. There wasn't that same impression in the Pacific War, not even among American soldiers, but in Europe, there was that spirit de corps. You kind of saw that about yourself, and then other people saw it about you too. We're gonna have to get that back, and maybe it will take another war. I just don't know who that enemy is going to be. And frankly, if it was going to be some enemy, I'm afraid that it would be shooting at each other again, rather than shooting at a foreign nation. I mean, I think we need to chill out. I think we need to stop being angry. I think we need to get our bearings. We need to look at our own history honestly, and we need to then make decisions that are based upon not just our emotions, or not based upon living up to a certain persona, whether it's conservative or liberal or progressive or socialist or capitalist or American or global citizen or white or black or whatever we want to, we can't live in a persona. We have to live really in the spirit, like it also says in the Bible, it says, if you live in the spirit, then also walk in the spirit. So if we are thinking about things with our spiritual eyes, seeing the world's problems through, is this something that is noble? Is this something that is good? Is this something that is going to have good consequences? And I mean good as in right on a spiritual plane. Well, then goodness, like good results, peace and prosperity and justice and fairness and true liberty will follow.
All right, Andrew, we'll go ahead and end it there. You can let people know where they can find you on social media and where they can find Beck and Stone.
Oh, Nat, yeah. If somebody wants to follow me and either yell at me or maybe just talk to me, I'm Andrew Beck USA on Twitter. And you can also connect with me on LinkedIn. And if you want to work at Beck and Stone or want to work with us, of course, we will always appreciate clients who value what we do, and then won't mind if the founder goes on podcasts like this one. Visit our site and get in touch.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Andrew, for coming on. Really appreciate it, getting your perspective. And thanks everyone for watching and listening. See you in the next one.
Bye, Shane.